Welcome, everybody. Last time we did this, I turned off the recorder, and only Kelly McFarland's backup recording saved us, so I'm trying to be sure we don't do that again this time. So first of all, thanks to everybody for being here. It's, as everybody said, it's great to be back here again. It's wonderful to have so many people here, especially since we're doing a refuge retreat, so to support the people taking refuge, that's really special. And as everybody said, the leadership team, both the retreat planning committee and then the retreat leaders have done a tremendous amount of work. So thank you to everybody again, but Martha thanked everybody also. Nobody thanked Martha yet, so thank you, Martha, for everything you're doing. And Megan, thanks for being here. It's wonderful to have a chance to teach together again. So I'll say a bunch of stuff tonight. I was thinking, well, you know, what's it really about? And when Martha was doing what she called her rambling, that was basically it, you know. So you never know what's going to happen in a retreat. Anything can happen, and just sort of being available to fall open to what might happen is a great way to be in a retreat. A lot of the time, I think meditation can go intensely inward, and that can be really great, but it's kind of easy to kind of put yourself in lockdown in that way. And there's also a way in which we can just sort of flow outward into what's going on around us, and in which, let's say, your meditation is already there in the desert just waiting for you, and all you have to do is sort of flow into that and let yourself fall open into it. So the approach is, you know, when it's easy, let it be easy. So there's that. And I'll be trying to mention a couple of pretend koans toward the end, some of you have heard recently, that I think are actually good ways of kind of inducing that or allowing that to happen. So that's where the talk is headed. And now we'll get really lost in the weeds, and I'll try to reduce some confusing context for it. But that's really what it's for. Right? So since it's a refuge retreat, it's worth mentioning, I guess, a good place to start. This is how the refuge ceremony starts. When knowing stops, when thoughts about who we are fall away, vast space opens up and love appears. Anything that gets in the way of understanding this is a cause of suffering and something to refrain from. Moment by moment, thought appears, the earth appears, we appear. So this is odd in a way. Knowing stops, which is a good thing apparently, but when it does, moment by moment, thought appears, rising and falling. Also a good thing, apparently. Whatever this mysterious knowing stops might mean, which I'll try to come back to later, there's something that feels relaxed, free and easy about what continues in its absence. Moment by moment, thought appears, the world appears, we appear. It's free and easy, crucially, about thought, which might bring us, by way of stark contrast, to Weka and his torment concerning his own troublesome mind. And this is a koan many of you know. It's really short, but I'll break it up anyway. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. Weka, who would become the second ancestor, stood in the snow and cut off his arm. He said, "My mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, put it to rest for me." Yipes. Weka's focus here is turned determinedly inward. It seems like he experiences his mind as his own special torment, his own private Idaho, which he's got to subdue first in order for other good stuff to happen. Bodhidharma goes right along with Weka's sense of what ails him, or pretends to, cannily encouraging him to pursue the project implicit in Weka's way of thinking. Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind, and I'll put it to rest." As if to say, you're the knower, grasp that troublesome object that's your mind and bring it back here, or bring me back what your analysis has determined about it, what you've succeeded in knowing about it, and then I can help you get it under control. Let's subdue that unruly beast. This sounds like one possible version of Meditation 101. It turns out to be a wild goose chase. After a while, the second ancestor returned to Bodhidharma and said, "I've researched for my mind, but I can't find it." And then, wait for it, Bodhidharma said, "I have put it completely to rest for you." This sounds like the punchline to a weird Zen joke. a Chon Shaggy Dog story. And it is, in a way, but it's also revelatory, at least for Weka, who appears to have had a sudden opening, though the Cohen doesn't bother to say so. The trajectory of this little story is odd, for sure, but what it reveals is crucial and, in an odd way, really good news. The failure of Weka's quest to find and know what he's looking for produces not frustration or continued torment, but dramatic relief. His mind is a separate, troubling, problematic object he needs to whip into shape, goes poof, and then surprisingly, in its disappearance as a knowable object, it's completely at rest. Or if it's somehow not there anymore as a separate thing, Weka is at rest. Or the world is. Or something is. But wait, are you kidding? Isn't the hallmark of Bodhidharma's teaching supposed to be pointing directly to the mind? From the point of view arrived at here, it looks like there's no mind to point to. Note, though, that chapter 1 of Ben Connolly's new book about Vasubandhu's three natures, a germinal text of the Yogacara mind-only school, is titled, "There is no mind in mind only." So, bad joke, maybe we haven't lost our minds here. I'm sorry for that. This going poof of the mind Wake is looking for reminds me of the last two lines of our Kanseon, which might be helpful here. Thought after thought rises in the mind. Thought after thought is the mind. Thought after thought rises in the mind. Thoughts come and go, it would seem, in a kind of separate, private little box. I might think of the box as enclosed tightly in my skull, but I might, on the other hand, imagine myself and my experiences as enclosed or locked inside this mind, which might feel like tight quarters. And it's tormented in here, says Weka. Help! Nope, the next line says, thought after thought is the mind, which implies that the thoughts rising and falling are all there is of mind. There's no box, no separate interior space walled off from the world, no separate entity that I need to subdue before I can join the world. Thoughts seem to float free in an open, unbounded space, not walled off from whatever else is floating around out there in the world, rising and falling. So maybe the project of getting what we think of as the box all tidied up isn't the best path to peace or the easiest way out of torment. I've searched for my mind, but I can't find it. Sounds frustrating, but no. As Bodhidharma says, I have completely put it to rest for you. This story can be understood as one instance of a pervasive Buddhist or Chan deconstructive project, the dismantling of the illusion that's a feature, not a bug, of knowing or conceptualization. The notion that the world is made up of separate, discrete, nameable entities cognized by a separate knowing, speaking subject, self or manas, whose task is to master or manipulate these known objects. The Lanka and Yogacara call this illusion imagined reality, somewhat dismissively. So when knowing stops, you know, it's not a project of knowing. But the particulars here of this particular story, with its focus on pointing directly to the mind, which turns out not to exist as the kind of separate entity Weka wants to get a grip on, seem to offer us immediate and intimate relief, since it's right here at home. When knowing stops. If knowing is instrumental, the key way humans work on problems, by triaging or conceptualizing them, maybe knowing also predisposes us to see things as a problem. Not that things aren't, but they aren't only a problem. That seems to be the case for Weka. In the moment when knowing comes up short, just throws up its hands or throws in the towel, well, as Bodhidharma says, I have completely put it to rest for you. When knowing has slipped a cog, when the task at hand has evaporated for a moment, there's just a purposeless rising and falling. Thought after thought rises in the mind. That after thought is the mind, which turns out to feel not dopey, but serene. Maybe that's the freedom offered by a wonderful koan John Tarrant made up. Quick! Don't get ready. Nothing to do, right? I think one source of the serenity here is that in their rising and falling, thoughts seem to be doing what everything else is doing, something pervasive enough that simple sensation, without a lot of cognitive modeling or fine-tuning, can follow and feel itself part of. Everything, as Joan Sutherland says, rising and falling in a really big field. The continual weaving and unweaving, as David Hinton puts it, of presence emerging out of and as absence, of form out of and as emptiness. Moment by moment, thought appears, the earth appears, we appear. Here's Suzuki Roshi. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. Here Suzuki adds something to what we've been saying so far, which may not be logically entailed, but turns out to be so in experience. That seeing and being, this endless rising and falling, also lets us see and be part of the harmony and perfect balance Suzuki evokes. Sound and silence, motion and stillness, temporal flow and eternity. Looked at from afar, the Shirangama Sutra says, swift flowing water is tranquil and still. And it turns out it's tranquil and still up close as well. So a couple takeaways. First, maybe the relief we're craving doesn't come through knowing. Better living through chemistry, an old TV ad used to say. So better living through cognitive modeling. True, but not always true. Second, maybe a fierce attempt to get my own mind in order is counterproductive and extra. Third, in the poof of this first and second, commitment to knowing and modeling, commitment to whipping myself into shape, we're at rest. Because we're no longer apart from, but are part of the world. A world which, surprisingly, is also at one deep level, profoundly at rest. When we fall into this field, or realize we've never fallen out of it, we feel that there's nothing that needs doing. Everything, as the tradition says, is perfect as it is. That's not the whole story, of course. So human knowing, our incessant model making and model tweaking, is adaptive. The human way of joining the project of natural selection that Darwin adumbrated. A good thing, probably, on the whole. Zen accordingly tries not to be an absolutism or a fundamentalism. You know, knowing's got its place. So. But our instrumental relation to the world, our power to triage and manipulate by means of our categories and models, if it's whirring along incessantly, whisks us right by some essentials we really can't live without, or can't really live without. One, the stark aspect of things that confronts us with, you can't think your way out of this one, bub, dying, for instance. Or two, the aspect wake-up falls into, in which nothing is out of place, nothing needs fixing, not even our mind or ourselves. What a shame to miss that, to be so busy with problem solving that we charge right by it, oblivious. The shift I've been talking about here is one way of understanding what the tradition means by turning the mind around. We typically experience our thoughts as instruments, problem solving tools, turned outward towards objects. We see the world in the terms our models give us and grab hold of or manipulate things by means of the physical tools those models let us conceive and make. But in the moments when knowing stops, when it feels safe enough and we're lucky enough to let problem solving fall away, thought after thought rises in the mind, thought after thought is the mind. We don't use thoughts as instruments to do something else, we just look at them. Gosh, look at the artwork, as it says somewhere in Pogo, it's one of my favorite comic strips. We watch them rise and fall, observing with a kind of purposeless curiosity or wonder, images or snippets of phrases that themselves seem to have no special purpose, just part of an ongoing, unfolding, interweaving. Thought appears, the world appears, we appear. Everything, as Suzuki says, losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. That feels like a greater gift than Wake a bargain for, like a much bigger deal than what he thought he wanted. So, Here are a couple wannabe koans that seem to be helpful in allowing this turning the mind around to occur without any special effort on our part. One reason they tend to help is that they take the focus off ourselves and our heart minds as some problem we need to fix first, or as something we need to monitor critically. Don't check your own mind, as the Tibetan Lama told a young John Tarrant in Australia once. These koans can ease us into something that's always already so, no entrance exam required. If you don't have anything better to do tomorrow, you might spend some time with one or more of them. All of these are good to sit with, but maybe even better to bring along on a walk. So this one is just made up, right? So there's something already at rest. Where is it? There's something already at rest. Where is it? And then this one is from the beginning of the Yongzhe Xuanzhui that's part of our afternoon readings. There is someone at peace walking in the Tao. There is someone at peace walking in the Tao. Or our old familiar, this is the stone drenched with rain that points the way. And by the way, just to touch in on knowing again, the Yongzhe Xuanzhui goes on, there is someone at peace walking in the Tao beyond theories, not fleeing delusion, not seeking truth. But to spend time with, I think, just there is someone at peace walking in the Tao is simpler and better. And there's no need to worry whether this someone is you or to work at trying to make it you. That seems really important. You say, oh, am I the one that you're screwed? So I'm not the one. Just there's someone at peace walking in the Tao. Don't worry about who it is. All right, almost done here. But one filigree or additional koan invitation. Since this is a refuge retreat, and since in our tradition we take up the vows as koans, here's a morphed version of the three refuge vows. In this carry-around koan-inflected version, knowing can take a vacation. We're not required to figure something out first in order to then go in search of it. It's not like, first I need to know exactly what awakening is, you know, or first tell me what exactly awakening is, and then I can figure out how to take refuge in it. Instead, we let something come fetch us. Not, I take refuge in awakening, which is the actual vow, but a koan-like inquiry. What is awakening, I wonder? Or even better, I think, where is awakening, I wonder? That's great to walk around with. Where is awakening, I wonder? Or where is the way, I wonder? Or where are my companions, I wonder? Nothing to pin down here. Nothing for you to go out and find. What you think you're looking for will find you. Though it likely won't be quite what you expected. And then, whoops, you've already joined it. Now, how did that happen? It's a gift. Sometimes our hearts just fall open and we just receive it. Thank you.